Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's how you quantify what a success is. Like, I've had loads. The more I do it, the more I realise the best bits are the bits when you're enjoying the process and really having. We're so lucky that I'm in a job that when it's going well, the end result is laughter.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to writer, executive producer, and founder of the production company Happy Tramp, Neil Webster. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. In 2013, Neil co-founded the comedy drama production company Happy Tramp with director Ben Palmer. They produced sitcom series for BBC One, sketch shows for BBC Two, BAFTA-nominated short film, and a number of half-hour films for Sky Arts Urban Myths, two of which were nominated for an international Emmy. In 2017, Neil decided he had enough of London and relocated to the Highlands of Scotland, where he established Happy Tramp North. They've since produced the highly acclaimed drama Guilt for BBC Two, as well as the sitcom series Semi-Detached, also for BBC Two, starring Lee Mack. And before setting up Happy Tramp, Neil co-founded the legendary comedy production company Zeppatron, where he worked as a creative director from 2000 until 2012, overseeing writing, producing, exec producing, developing talent, dealing with commissioners, and as you'll hear, having lots of fun along the way. In addition to all things TV related, Neil co-hosts the podcast series I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha with Lee Mack, where they discuss all things Buddhist related, and that's something the two of us talk about in greater detail in this conversation. And as always, if you like this episode, if you like Balancing Acts, the series, then please do rate and review us on Apple. Give us the 5 stars, mate. It's very, you know, it does wonders for my ego. Not that obviously I don't have an ego, as you'll hear through this conversation. We're talking all things Buddhist related. I've got rid of it. It's gone. It's completely gone. But it's just nice, isn't it? It's always nice. It's as nice as a child to receive stars for doing good things. You know, my mum would put a little star on the fridge every time I behaved myself, which wasn't very often. I was a very, very naughty kid. Anyway, I digress. And also, if you would like to be part of the newsletter, you can subscribe to that on Steve Whiteley, WHITELEY.co. Sign up there to the newsletter and won't bombard you. Giving you just a little reminder every now and then when we have a new conversation out on the podcast. So without further ado, over to Neil Webster. Perfect.
You're used to the podcast format now, aren't you? Because you and Lee Mack have got I Can't Believe It's Not Buddha, which I listened to, and it's a lot of fun. I can imagine it must be a really nice thing to be doing something like that with one of your close pals.
Yeah, no, it's good. I do really enjoy it. It's kind of stumbled into existence, which is good, because anything that we plan too much, we end up falling out over. So it's quite nice to do a thing. We're both like, you know, it's come. We have talked about. I did a podcast pilot of my own about 3 years ago called The Podcast from the End of the World.
Okay.
And the kind of premise was that we'll get on to like the reason I live, who I live, and all that stuff. But the premise was that the world had ended. Who knew? And each week within the confines of this of this show, I leave my bunker, find a straggling survivor, bring them back to my bunker, ask them what they miss the most from pre-Armageddon and what they like the most post-Armageddon. And through their answers, I decide whether to let them stay in the bunker or I kill them.
Nice.
And the idea was that I killed my guest every week.
Okay.
So I did it with Lee, and I went around to his house and we recorded it and we really enjoyed it. And I put it all together and then I thought, oh, you know, I'm not that. Like, I wanted to try doing one, but I wasn't that bothered about how it came out. It was fun. And then for about 2 years we went, that was good, that. We had really good fun doing that. We should do a podcast. And then we both said, but we don't want to do a podcast about a thing that we're not interested in.
Yeah.
And so it was a weird thing where, like, kind of in tandem with that, we've both been getting into Buddhism. We both gave up drinking over the years and all of those things. And then one day we went, that's all we kind of talk about. So if we're going to try a podcast, let's do it on that. Mm. And so it's kind of nice. Although, you know, like everything, it flirts between the line of fun and work.
Yes, yes, as does all these things, because you underestimate how much work goes into making a podcast.
Lee does, certainly. Weekly. But that's kind of also kind of the dynamic of the podcast.
So before we, because obviously I want to get onto the Buddhist chat.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's what our link is.
It's what I'm known for.
Yeah, so our link is Mark Boutros. And he said, oh, he's one of you lot to me.
Yeah.
So you guys should chat. So very, very interested to find out your path into all things Buddhahood.
Man.
But just to kick things off then. So did you start off writing for stand-ups or in terms of your career, or did you, because I know you're working on the 11 o'clock show. Were you writing for stand-ups prior to doing that?
I was only writing for Lee.
Okay.
So I did like a very quick history. I did a pop music degree in Salford and I lasted about 3 months, which I thought qualified me.
Pop music?
Yeah, it was Salford. I don't know what it's called now. It was Salford Tech then. And it was kind of set up by Paul McCartney. It was Music Institute.
Right.
And it's set up by George Martin. On the first day, we had a weird visit to the Coronation Street set with George Martin and none of it made any sense. but I I did this course and I lasted about 3 months and then dropped out, which I thought made me qualified to be a rock star, right? That's kind of the point. You don't finish the course.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did that, came back to, I was up in Manchester in Salford, and then came back, got onto a drama degree, not a brilliant one, but an all right one. They make me say that. No, I met Lee on that and he started doing stand-up. And so over the course of those 3 years, we got to know each other. We did an Edinburgh show together. He would like won So You Think You're Funny in like mid-90s. And then we did a little sketch show together, which was the only time I've ever performed, thankfully. And then he went on and was doing more and more, got a show called Gas on Channel 4. And I was working for a record company because I was still going to be a rock star at that point. And then I was running a little recording studio for the record company and I was getting paid like insanely low amounts of money. And he got a job and said, oh, they're looking for joke writers. They've given me some joke writers to make this show. It's called Gas and it was a stand-up show. And he said, oh, I've asked if you can come and do it. And like now, subsequently being a producer for how many years, it's like the last thing you ever want to hear. Whenever someone new comes along and goes, yeah, my mate's going to write it with me.
Yeah,
don't worry. We've got people that can do that. People who know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But he got me in for a few weeks and I made like, it wasn't riches, but it was about 4 months of my money at the record company, which is more a reflection on the record company money than the telly money. And then I did that. And then I did a second series, went back to the record company, did the second series, and then made a little show, got on the 11 o'clock show. I heard through a friend of a friend, they were looking for writers. And I made a little show reel. And I took it to Harry Thompson, who was the kind of god of that show when it started, the producer. He got my tape and got me into, this is the first tape I've had that's made me laugh for ages. And the thing he was referencing was a joke that I hadn't written, but I was in the background of, that Lee had written. So I thought, oh, I'll put that in there because I'm in it. Right. And so I got this gig. My whole career was a lie. I got this gig based on a joke I didn't write.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. And then I was on the 11 o'clock show for like 3 or 4 years.
And what was that experience like?
Oh, it's like, I can't really remember. So long. No, it was mental. It was properly mental. It was the weird thing was that was my only experience of telly. And I just thought, well, this is what telly is like. It's like you, there was me and three, then four other main writers. We were like the kind of core writers of the show. And there's a guy called Peter Holmes, who runs Zeppetron now, we all started together after Talkback, after 11 o'clock show. Ben Cordell, Peter Holmes, me, a guy called Charlie Skelton, and a guy called Charlie Brooker. And so we were the kind of core writing team who were like, would write every day. You get in the morning, you'd write all day. Whatever shit you wrote ended up on telly that night, which you can imagine the bar is so low. It was like stuff would go out and you go, like, that's on television. We said awful things about people that weren't really vetted in any way. Like they had a kind of Channel 4 lawyer there the whole time, but it was such a barrage of filth and low rent jokes that they could only stop a certain amount of it going out without there being nothing on the show. So we did that for like, I did three series of that. And they were long series. They were like 11, 12-week runs, 3 nights a week. And you'd work from like 6 in the morning till the bar ITV closed at midnight. And then you'd go back. Often, Ben Cordell had a habit of getting drunk and going back to the kind of props cupboard and just sleeping on Sasha's Ali G costumes. I don't think anyone ever knew that. It was an amazing place because it was everybody who I know in telly now worked on that show, and it was just all these 20 somethings kind of let loose.
What an incredible experience. And obviously during that, as you said, Sasha was on that show and Ricky was on that show. Mm. You looking at those guys sort of thinking,
nah. These guys, what do you mean, no?
I thought you said nah straight away before I'd even
no.
I like, nah, nah, nah.
Not them.
Didn't rate them,
not
mate.
Them. Get to me.
Did you look at those guys and think, like, from the off, yeah, these guys are, they've got it?
I don't think anybody really knew anything. Like, okay, it was just talk about kind of imposter syndrome. I was there going, I have no idea what I'm doing here. Like, I was in no position to judge anybody. Or I had, like I remember the first time we watched an Ali G tape came in. And you just go, this is really funny. Like, this is just, you just go, this is really funny. But then also there'd be other tapes that come and you go, this is really funny. A guy's dressed up as a toucan and run onto a cricket pitch. That's funny. With the music, toucan play that game. That was, you go, oh, that's funny. But he was obviously, like, it became really apparent really quickly on that show that people had only ever watched it for the last 4 minutes, which is when they put the Ali G bit on. You know, you trail it all the way through the show to keep people watching. But yeah, that was brilliant. And then Ricky kind of came and went a lot. He did a bit, then went away, then did a bit, then went away. And like, I remember being in the bar with him. And I think Lee had been a guest on the show that week. And I remember Ricky sitting there. And I wasn't close to Ricky. It was all like a kind of gang of us and stuff. And Ricky going, God, I'm 35 now. I think I've missed my opportunity. And you go, God, man, like now you go, yeah, well, obviously that wasn't the case. But yeah, no, it was like a terrible show. It spawned some amazing people.
Yeah. What a great sort of accidental way into comedy.
Yeah. It was kind of terrifying though. It was brilliant and terrifying because you just think there were a lot of people there who'd come from those big gang shows like The Big Breakfast and stuff.
Yeah.
So they were kind of used to, it was quite rough and ready. It was a bit like going to Borstal. It was a bit like there were people that were, you get people who would be bullied quite quickly, people who would be in the gang, people who'd be out of the gang. It just had quite a feral feeling to it. So it was kind of good, but also you just think, God, like one wrong move, I'm sunk here. But yeah, it was good fun.
So after that experience, did you directly go on to set up Zeppetron then? Co-found Zeppetron straight after?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there was 5 or 6 of us who had been part of like that talk. There was a massive talk about development that led to the 11 o'clock show. So we'd been there 6 months. Like it's insane now that Channel 4 paid for like 6 months development. And there were 4 writers. That was me, Peter, Ben and Charlie Skelton. And we basically got paid for 6 months to sit in the Talkback offices and think about what a show might be like And we were just, like, honestly, we're just drunk from, like, midday. We'd go out and drink loads of wine at lunch and play the card game Hearts for hours. Then we'd write some really terrible sketches and do that for 6 months. So we'd kind of become a family before it had started in a weird way. And then 3 years down the line, we were still like in our early 20s, I was probably 24, 25. And we'd seen so many producers come through, like day producers and VT producers. And some of them were brilliant, but some of them were absolutely terrible, like telly, right? And so we thought, oh, how hard can it be to run a company? So that's really hard. But at that point we went, oh, we're just going to start our own company. And so we set up Zeppotron. And that was me. That ended up being me, Peter, Ben, all these names, Charlie Brooker, and a couple other people that kind of went quite quickly after we set up. And we went to see Peter Bazalgette, who ran Endemol at the time, and said, do you want to leave Endemol and become the chairman of our company? And he went, no, you're all right. I've got a company, thanks. We're doing all right. But do you want to come and sit in our basement and we'll give you a bit of seed money and see how you get on? And that's how we started. We started Zeppotron in 2000.
So from that place of starting as a writer, then you go and set up your company and then you start producing, you know, in your own right and EPing. Was that a difficult transition to go from that place where you've just been having a laugh and now you sort of got a business side of, you know, overlooking that sort of stuff as well?
We never really had a business, if I'm honest. We were kind of, when we started, they said, come up with a 5-year plan.
Okay.
And we came up with a 5-year plan that had, at the end of it, we were going to, our 5-year plan was at the end, was going to end with launching a theme park. And this is what we put in the 5-year plan.
And our, stuff.
Yeah, totally. And we said, like, some of it, oddly, some of it in the...
Put that in the plan? You put it in
the whole plan was in 5 years' time, they said, all we want to see from you is ambition. So don't hold back. So we went, yeah, okay, fine, leave it with us. Right, we're going to have a theme park in 2005. We honestly, and there's some stuff in Innovations, which was the brand thing that was like the Innovations catalogue that Brooker had come up with that we made into a TV show, that we basically, genuinely, I think it was one of Brooker's ideas, obviously, came up with Twitter on one of these things as a joke, like this thing where people post up in a sentence or less what they're up to. And it was like a joke thing that buzzes and tells you what some actor's just gone and bought some bread, which we thought was hilarious at the time, and obviously. But so this business plan was 5 years. We had we had the theme park at the end. We were called Tron Pipe then rather than Zeppotron.
Okay.
Because that's what we called the internet, was the Tron Pipe. Everything gets shoved up the Tron Pipe eventually. And they said, well, you can't have that name, it's ludicrous. We went, all right, we'll choose the least funny Marx brother, and we called it Zeppotron instead. So it's our favorite film of the future with the least funny Marx brother to keep expectations low. So that was the plan. We had on the front of the 5-year proposal, completely unreferenced, we had a picture of the Yorkshire Ripper, and no one ever asked us why we did that.
Wow.
So it was just nuts. It was like the whole running the company was a massive piss take.
Do you think you could get away doing that today?
Of course not. I don't think so. I just think it was also, we were seen as all because of Charlie, because Charlie had done this site TV Go Home, which is how the 11 o'clock show had found him. And it was, you know, it's a fake listing of a kind of Radio Times thing that doesn't really exist now. But it was brilliant and it was really funny. There was loads of ideas. All, like, so many TV producers subsequently said, oh, we just plundered that. And like Touch the Truck was like a Charlie joke, you know, all of these weird shows. And so because he'd run his own website, and then he was in 11 o'clock show, then we started talking, they just thought we were like these future kids who knew what the internet was, and we were just Luddites. Like, we were the least technical people, but they were much older than us. We'd have a board meeting every month where we realized we're never making any money. We weren't EPs. There's no way we could EP a show. And we thought, oh, we worked out pretty quickly that all their meetings were really dry, so as long as we made them laugh, they would kind of wouldn't say anything till the next month. They go, what's on your slate? We couldn't get meetings anywhere. So we weren't really EPing at all, to be honest. The first show we did that was the big show that kind of kept us going was 8 out of 10 Cats. And we didn't EP that. Like,
how'd you get that one away then?
Someone more senior in the building probably pitched it. Probably Tim Hinks, who was our mate and was running it by then. think he probably pitched it. I don't even know if we had the idea, if I'm honest, because it's terrible, isn't it? I can't remember. But I don't think, I definitely didn't. I'm not that smart. And then that kind of bankrolled us for a few years until other things. Then we started doing, and we'd all been kind of script writers. So we all ended up doing a lot more entertainment stuff because you're at Endemol.
Okay.
And so you do some script stuff, but then, you know, I did a Shiny Floor Saturday night show with Bradley Walsh, which like I really enjoyed doing at the time, but it wasn't what I thought I was going to do.
So you were happy to park the scripted side of things to focus on that at that time?
For a while, yeah. Like I was happy to do it because it was a job and it was quite, and I was still in a room with the same three or four mates.
Okay.
And it got a bit harder as time went on because, you know, the demands of actually having a company starts. But there was always this idea with Zeppotron that they hated, that we loved, that we were like this kind of socialist collective. So when we went there, we went, we're all going to get paid the same. We're all going to have the same title. It's going to be great. Because anyone comes up, we have that idea that if you're in a room and you come up with ideas, like someone could come up with the idea, but someone could add one bit to it. And the moment you start going, that's my idea, it makes the room unworkable because you go, well, if that's your idea, you go and finish it then. Because if you like, then you're taking ownership and ultimately you're taking the money from that, you know. So for a long time, the idea was that we all got paid the same, regardless of who came up with what. And I don't think Endemol liked that very much because I don't think many people, you know, it's not a, people like to carve things out and go, where's the value in this thing? And ultimately, I suppose, then Charlie got famous, rightfully so. And then like one day, I think we're all sitting there, and I think Charlie might have been on like the 10 o'clock show or a version of one of those shows. And he's a kind of host of it. And I think he's going, wait a minute, I'm getting paid the same as you three who are just sitting here staring into space all day. Okay, that's not, it's not. And there's all these other people on the show that are getting paid a fortune. And so, yeah, at that point, you kind of go, yeah, I think this model doesn't really work anymore.
And
so,
then did it become more of a serious outfit from then onwards? Was it more business orientated?
It was all, yeah, it always kind of was like slid that way. Like we were kind of running it. And then Annabelle, who now runs all the stuff with Charlie, who they've got a company together, she came in and was, like, she kind of whipped us into shape. She was like...
Was she a producer at the time?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. She wasn't like a TV producer. I think she was more business. And then,
okay.
But she obviously had all of that kind of skill set. But I think she'd come from a business background. And I think they'd gone, there's those like blokes we don't quite know what to do with. And they're making some funny shows. We made a show called Space Cadets, which is probably a whole other discussion, which was this huge attempt at fooling people that we'd taken them into space. Remember, she got involved before that and really helped get that made. And I think there was a level of, she's just smart, just good at presenting in a room and going, we're going to trust these people with all this money to make this thing. And I don't think you would have trusted some of us at that point. So they kind of moved that way. But then we all grew up and we all got better at it and it got less fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. God, that sounds like such a fun experience, such a fun way of doing it. Well, I just mean in terms of like, you know, a band of mates who just decide to just set up a company and you just sort of, I don't know, yeah. I feel like now it's like a very, not cynical, but it's quite a definitive thing. You go, right, we're going to set up a production company and we're going to look for our first commission. And it's like quite a professional thing. Whereas you guys, because you started so young, you could afford to have a bit of fun with it for a while.
Yeah. Like there was all kinds of stupid ideas when we first started. Like I'm sure, I don't know, oh, who cares? No one doesn't matter anyway. But I remember when I think I just read that that book on the start, like how grand were our schemes. That book on what's the book on Hollywood that's about the rise of Hollywood, and it's called something. Oh, it's got two film references, like Raging Bull, something, but it's not that.
I mean, yeah.
And I just read that, and I went, "Yeah, it's great. We're going to set up at Endemol. We're in the roof of this building in Tottenham Court Road." And I went, "Why don't we just buy like a massive jar of grass, and whoever wants to go." And I was just like, "Oh yeah, this is going to be great. We're going." You go, "No, that doesn't work." We went out and like, "Go, yeah, let's get some table football and some grass. It'd be great." But that was, you know, all bullshit. So it was kind of fun, but it was also. It was fun at first, and it was fun. Like it's still running now, and I still work for Zeppotron quite a lot. Okay. And there's still a lot of my mates are there, and I love them, and it's great. So it's still it's definitely a different company now than the one that was bashing about.
Okay, and at the time, were you also then writing for stand-ups whilst you were producing and EPing, etc.?
Yeah, not a massive amount. Like stuff within, like we were doing stuff within Zeppotron, and then we made like sketch shows and stuff and
okay,
other bits and bobs. So there's still writing going on, but not a huge amount. And then I was doing bits and bobs with Lee outside of Zep. So a bit of writing for a tour or some stuff like that. But there was stuff like you'd end up a lot of gag writing in rooms. So a lot of stuff early on in the writing room for Jimmy Carr on 8 out of 10. And then Jason Manford would host the things. So he'd write some stuff with him, or we did some stuff with all of that kind of generation stand-ups. And then probably the one that for me that I stuck with is writing for Frankie Boyle. And okay, so I still now write on New World Order, which is my favourite thing to write on.
And is that a collaborative process between you both?
Not just me. Okay. No, it's made... Well, Charlie Skelton, who goes way back to the 11 o'clock show, he's like the script editor, and Charlie and Frankie are like the proper brains.
Okay.
And then I'm in the room with them. I often think I'm in there as a foil. Like if I understand what's going on, there's a chance it might... It might be at a level that they're both so like smart and funny. But it's very much Frankie. Like Frankie's, you know, you do gag writers' rooms where you're pitching gags for a punchline for a bit, and Frankie, you sit and talk often quite bleakly and in quite like bone crushing depth about the end of the world or the Hadron Collider or stuff. But Frankie, you don't write jokes with Frankie. Most of the time, Frankie writes it all out in longhand himself. So you're chatting away, and something will spark to him, and he'll start writing things down. And then it's kind of all very much authored through his brain.
Okay,
but it's fascinating, and he's brilliant. So I love it.
Yeah, I can imagine it. And so is it then a unique experience with each stand up or comic that you're working with when you're writing material? They've all got their own different processes.
Yeah, they've got their own processes, and like. There's always that thing where people think, oh, you know, stand-ups have got writers, they're not doing it themselves. And it's always a bit of a lie, that, because you know, there's just a reality that if people are on telly and they've got to generate so many minutes of television each week, like a tour, if someone does an hour tour, they'll hone it, or an hour and a half tour, they'll hone it over a year, and then obviously they'll do the same set every night. They're not making it up from scratch. And so people go, oh, they've got, right, look at the writers list on that show. And you go, yeah, but it's all predominantly them. But you're kind of, you're just generating stuff that they can process a bit quicker. And you will write jokes that they'll take, but you'll also give them ideas. And I think Frankie's probably the most abstract version of that model, where you're not pitching jokes to him. He has a very particular way, you know, you've heard his stuff. He has a particular, you don't really write in his style. It kind of becomes a cloud of things, and he cherry picks and makes it his. But then other people, with 8 out of 10 cats, you pitch jokes about Susie Dent, you know, that's what you do. And then I don't know, when Lee and I used to write stuff for his stand-up, we had a very particular method. We'd sit in a room and kind of slightly, this goes, it's a long time ago, but our favorite method was getting a pile of like magazines from everywhere, and then take turns, and we go pick a page number and a corner. So you go like page 12, left bottom left corner, the first thing you read there or saw there, you then both go and write for 10 minutes on any material. And then after 10 minutes, you read it to each other and invariably you go, well, that was shit. Let's do it again. And you do that for 8 hours. And at the end of that 8 hours, you might have a couple of minutes of worth of material that Lee would then try out possibly that night in a comedy club.
That's a great approach. I haven't heard that before. That's sort of like quite improv led.
Well, kind of, but it was just going, you just need stimulus the entire time.
Yeah.
So we'd write stuff and we'd just go, if you sit down and go, right, let's write some stand-up. Like where do you, if you open a magazine at that point and go, here's an advert for a bath, a stand-up bath, then you've got a starting point, whether it's a sketch or we did it for sketch shows as well, but we did it for stand-up, and it would just be anything. And then there might be a line within one of our bits that is not related to that. And you go, that's funny. And then we both then talk about that and try and build that up into something for 20 minutes. And then we move on again.
That sounds like a
lot of fun. And it's quite like, you know, workmanlike. You just go, we were quite into doing 10 till 6 and just doing 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes. And
so does that take some of the joy out of that process?
Not really, I don't think, because there's always that thing that it can be quite tiring, be quite tiring within the constraints of what you're doing. But
yeah,
it's also, if you make, you know, the great joy of this job in whatever form it is, if you make the person you're working with, you tend to think is a funny person. Mm. So if you make them laugh, then kind of your job's done, because you can never guess what the end result's going to be and how that's going to land. But when I'm working with people, like if I make Charlie Skelton laugh, I'm happy, because that, I think it's hard to make him laugh because he's heard everything.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so it's not, it was quite a productive way of doing stuff. And we're quite hard workers.
Having sort of, you know, done writing and producing, EPing and so forth, do you prefer writing to producing, EPing, or do you like them both for different reasons, different things?
I don't know. Like, it always feels like everyone, it always feels a bit impostery, whatever you're doing. Like, yeah, I really like writing when it's going well, and I really like EPing when it's going well. I really like producing when it's going well, but it's never going well. So I don't like any of it.
Do you still get that? Like, do you suffer from like imposter syndrome?
Oh,
after?
Totally. But so of course.
Yeah, that's kind of not crazy to me, but so interesting. You know, someone like you've done so many shows, you've had so much experience.
But I've had no success. Like, this is the whole thing. You just go, but you always, like, you're always judging your success by like the people around you. You go, like, Jesus, the amount of shows that have gone to a second series is like tiny.
But you co-founded like one of, you know, most successful TV production companies in the UK.
Yeah, that's, but that's like that. That's very kind of you to say so.
But
like,
it is, right?
I was there when it happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you're just being a Buddhist now.
No, I don't. Like, I honestly think there's an element of, I don't think I've done anything.
Okay.
Like, honestly, I'm not being like or maybe I'm being a prick. I don't know. But I'm not intentionally being a prick.
No, it's the opposite.
It's how you quantify what a success is. Like, I've had loads. The more I do it, the more I realize the best bits are the bits when you're enjoying the process and really having. We're so lucky that I'm in a job that when it's going well, the end result is laughter.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a byproduct. I've worked in jobs where you do anything to get around the job by trying to make your friends laugh because the job's so shit. But when the job end point is laughter and it's working, you go and you feel like there's a little bit of alchemy there. They're like, that's a massive privilege.
I mean, without wanting to sound like a cheesy dickhead, I mean, that in itself is success, isn't it? Having a career where you can do that on a day-to-day basis.
But I think you can do that. And that is success. But I think for certainly, you know, we're in the industry of absolute psychopaths who judge success by, am I doing better than the person I'm competing against? I think that's the kind of irony of not just comedy, but telly, is that the veneer is entertainment and everyone's getting on.
Yeah.
And the truth is, it's a really like nasty business.
Do you feel that?
I say it's nasty. The problem is, there's lots of big rewards and there's big people, there's ruthless people who will, when there's big money to be made, people will make big money. I think there's always been telly's a weird one where there's lots of creative people and lots of business people, and they are at opposite ends of the spectrum. And trying to do both is a clumsy business.
Yeah.
Because the people who make the money will be the people who make money. The creative people will be the people who are on some level exploited for that money. But you kind of pretend that they'll get on, I think. Like, I might be talking shit, but I think
that's a conflict in all creative industries, isn't it?
Like, yeah,
totally. That's exactly how it works in the music industry as well.
Yeah.
Same thing, record label owners and artists.
Yeah.
And there's like a 1% of the artists that do really well, and the other 99% that don't or are fucked over or whatever.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I've also realised that I've done very well out of it. Like, I've managed to have a job for 20 years, and being at Zeppotron was massively soft, that I had a regular wage coming in. And the fact that for a very long time we were a group of people who were on the same money in the same room did make us kind of slightly bulletproof, because naturally there's a divide and conquer in creative industries.
Yeah.
And we were lucky that we just weren't one. They go, well, I don't know, one of them's coming up with this shit. Which one is it? They go, we're not sane. So it kind of helped us, I think, for a long time. And we all were on like decent money. And then, as you get older, it does become, you do have to grow up a little bit, I suppose.
Yeah. And did you have any ambitions to try and make a pop at it out in the US, doing what you're doing over here? Would that not interest you at all?
No, not really.
Was it different? I mean, I guess it's slightly different there. It's like, feels like, you know, whatever, like the internet has made the world a lot smaller now. And so in essence, you don't even need to go there necessarily you can create shows over here that are then sold over there, which they did back then, but it feels like the gap is bridged a little bit now.
Yeah. I've got loads of mates who've done that and done very well out of it. And
right.
I'm a bit socially awkward, if I'm honest. I can't imagine, like, even at the moment, we're making Guilt, and there's a talk of whether we're going to go and pitch it in the US and that stuff, and it slightly fills me with dread, if I'm honest, to just go, oh, God. Like, but then I think that might be, I think I, like, you know, my ambition is waning in a positive way, I think.
yeah. Okay. And on the writer side of things, how have you dealt in the past, if you've had experiences where you've received notes from someone who, let's say, might have a different creative vision or interpretation of your project that you're working on?
Yeah.
How have you dealt with notes in those circumstances?
Notes, I think notes are like the amazing part of our work. Like, when I left Zebatron, I started a company called Happy Tramp with the director Ben Palmer, and that's still running now. And we have the same kind of attitude to notes, that we really welcome notes from good note givers. And I think sometimes you just go really quickly, you go, if someone's going to give notes, it's often a thing where someone will give you a note and it might be a bad note, but we tend to think, even if it's a note that we don't agree with, if they've offered a solution, the fact they've pinpointed an area means that there's something to look at there.
Yeah.
So I really well, like, I tend to give lots of notes, but I don't give, like, you know, you try and give respectful notes. You don't try and write something for somebody. You kind of go, that thing there, and it's always character. It's always like, why are they doing that? And why is that not quite ringing true? Why is that not quite hitting it? Or this story thing you can feel that that's been put in there to kind of put a sticking plaster over a thing that doesn't work. So I'm like a big fan of notes. That being said, bad note givers just drive you nuts, and you have both, right? So it's kind of not the note, it's the quality of the note.
Yeah.
That note's always hard, because if you write something, there's no greater feeling than writing something and finishing it, because writing's horrible. And when you finished it, you want everyone to go, yeah, it's perfect. Because the last thing you want to do is go, yeah, all of that bit in the middle that you cried over doesn't work. You have to do it again and do it better. So there's always that you want somebody to come back and say, I've got no notes. Brilliant, well done. And that's happened once to me on a project that I'm currently working on, and it might mean that it's rubbish. Or the note giver has gone, like, I don't even know where to start with this. Let's just not bother. Let's just pretend it's brilliant.
due to lockdown, they just don't have the energy.
Yeah, they just go, yeah, it's great. It's great. Well done. Yeah, you go, really? And there's definitely something wrong in there.
Yeah.
So notes. I know there's people get, the worst thing is people being precious for precious sake. People giving notes for notes' sake are a pain in the ass. And people being precious
as in writers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, I totally get the kind of energy and sometimes arrogance of newer writers going, I've written this thing and it's going to break all the rules.
Mm.
And they said, give you a thing, and you go, yeah, the problem is you can break all the rules, but you can break all the rules a second time. On the first time, do a thing that adheres to all the rules, because that's really hard. And trying to break all the rules often means you haven't learned the rules.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, you often get a thing, I don't know if you get the same thing, where you get, like, friends of a friend say, oh, you know, guy's come out of college and he's written a script and he wants someone to read it. And often, like most people, you get, some people don't want script notes to be told where it's going wrong. They want someone just to go, yeah, you're brilliant. And so that's a hard thing, because you go, yeah, I can give you notes, but the notes won't necessarily be, this is a work of genius, because no first draft of anything ever is. But I think when you're new, it's quite hard not taking notes. People go, no, well, that's all rubbish. I'm going to leave it as it is. You go, great. Well, leave it as it is, but good luck with it, because this is a collaborative industry ultimately, and there are people paying for it. And the people who pay for it have a say in how it's going to end up. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
And for writers who are trying to push in and get their first break in a writer's room,
yeah,
from your perspective as a production company owner, how do you go about, or what makes you decide to take a punt, not necessarily a punt, but bring someone into a writer's room where it might be their first experience in that setting?
To be honest, we don't do anything with writer's rooms. So like, I work with writers who write scripts,
okay,
and script edit a bit. But we don't do any, like, I suppose writers' rooms are for bigger dramas that we don't do, and panel shows that obviously Zeppatron did, but we don't do as Happy Tramp. And I don't know how you get in, to be honest. By the time we were doing that on Zeppatron, there were much better people who were finding people than us,
right,
to go. So you suddenly have, like, you know, people have come through the writers' rooms. It's such a weird old guard, because there used to be a lot more shows, weren't there? Of those kind of gag writing things where you could cut your teeth, like 11 o'clock show, and then going on all of those shows that were, and it doesn't feel like there were that many now. So okay, a lot of those writers' rooms are still staffed by the same 8 or 9 people,
yeah,
who are now in their late 40s, early 50s, which is all a bit sad, really, I think. But, well, good for them. They've got, you know, they make a living and they're really, really, really good at it, which, yeah, is the other thing. They've, yeah, got these muscles that are so honed. But then you get people like, you know, James Farmer.
No.
He's a guy he's a stand-up who worked in production and then ended up, there's often a role in a writer's room where there's someone who's the scribe who is taking everything down.
Okay.
Every time people are talking and they're just, you get a joke and they write it down. And so there's a kind of log of the day, and also nothing gets lost. And also kind of slightly sneakily, obviously the production company is keeping a check on people doing writing stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that space in that room has often been a springboard for people to then become writers. So I think James Farmer did it for a bit, but he's now a writer. He's like one of the younger, to me, younger generation who is in all the writers' room. He's a brilliant joke writer, and he's also a stand-up. And then like the stand-up Sophie Duker, who's now has been on New World Order, was that role in the room for a couple of series. So it's me, Charlie, Frankie, and her, and then people would kind of come in on, there's people come in like every day or every other day or something, but it would generally be the core of us four. So that's one way of getting into it. But now I don't know how you get into, like, I haven't got a clue. Like, I suppose that there's a performer writers or a way into the kind of gag writing rooms, but doesn't feel like, I don't know. Like, I don't, it's not really my world.
Yeah.
And then longer form narrative, you know, I'm working with a few new people today, and it tends to be stuff that I've worked with a few new writers programs, like BBC New Comedies program, and you kind of mentor people, and that's been really good. And I've met some people through there. We just did a pilot with a guy called Bryce Hart called Beep, we've just shot, which is a half hour kind of hospital comedy set in a private room of a hospital with the kind of patriarchs in a coma. And it's all about all the family in this kind of purgatory. So it's a very kind of gentle, small thing. But he wrote that through this program. And I've read that and just go, God, this guy's an amazing writer. So you're kind of quite lucky, you kind of chance upon people.
Mm.
And there's a couple of other things that I'm working on with people at the moment that you kind of get through. Often someone has spotted something online, someone more diligent than me, and has gone, have you seen this? And then you kind of go, oh, let's try and come up with an idea.
Yeah. So, okay. Now you're running your production company, Happy Tramp. After having gone through sort of that process of, you know, you've been running Zeppatron, and then, as you said, it became more grown up.
Mm.
Did you decide then to set up Happy Tramp because you wanted to have more fun running a production company, or did you just want ownership again?
I was just really, really seeking much more stress.
Okay.
How can I do?
Then becoming a Buddhist.
I needed something to kickstart the Buddhism. So I thought, why don't I put myself in the most stressful situation I could find? Now, the truth is, I've been at Zeppatron for like 12, 13 years.
Yeah.
And with those guys for 4 years before that. And I was just slightly going, I just thought, oh my God, I think I might end up dying here. I don't want that to happen. And it might be next week if I don't leave. So I we did a sketch show and I was execing it. And it was a weird sketch show that there was loads, this kind of drawer full of sketches that me, Peter, Ben and Charlie had written that had never gone anywhere. They're all quite weird and a bit didn't fit anywhere. And Channel 4 were doing some kind of, it was some kind of anniversary. And Shane was there at the time, and bless him, we've got these sketches. And he went, well, why don't you do a special for this thing? And so I was execing it. And then Ben Palmer came on to direct it. And then I was meeting producers. And I suddenly thought, what am I doing? Like, I really want to work with Ben. I'd written quite a few of those sketches. And I thought, I'm just about to give it to somebody else. And they're going to go and make it. And I'll go back into this room and try and come up with ideas for another panel show or something. So I thought, oh, I'm going to produce it. So I produced it with Ben directing. And it was just a two-part thing. It was called Them From That Thing. And it kind of came and went. But it was loads of fun to make because it was, again, it was a really stupid idea. We were trying to make a sketch show that was like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So every sketch, like a wall would fall out and then you'd be in the next sketch. And it would all try and do it all in camera in the way that film did. But obviously meant that the sketches couldn't be moved around. And all of the benefits of a sketch show were completely thrown out the window. It had to be this order before we shot it. And it was really expensive. There was no like, we're going to go back to that sketch six times. So it was like stupidly expensive sketch, which is why they didn't commission a series of it. But it was really good fun. And then I just started talking to Ben. And I went, well, do you want to try doing something? And so we set up Happy Tramp, and that was the plan. And then also the plan was for me to concentrate on doing scripted stuff because I've done so much entertainment stuff, which is what Zeppotron was kind of, it's a much better business model. Having Would I Lie to You, 8 out of 10 Cats, I don't know, Ranganation, all the other shows they do, Frankie's show, like those returning shows are much easier once they're up and running to have as a business model rather than we're going to try and write a new scripted show. And I thought, well, I've had all of the comfort of being at Endemol, getting a regular wage. So who wants that when you can live by the seat of your pants with no money and try and get a scripted show around? But the truth is also, I did the absolute opposite where we've got a tiny, tiny, tiny company now, which is basically, in terms of full-time people, there's two of us, me and the head of production. And so our cost base is now so the opposite end of most companies. We're like a kind of, I would say we're a bit like a terrorist cell that if it all goes wrong, we can clear out an office space within about 40 minutes and no one will ever know we existed. And so because of that, we can exist on far fewer shows. And we've got no great, we didn't start a company to go, a five-year plan, we're going to sell it to somebody, or there's no one to want it. Couldn't sell it to ourselves. So it's a kind of model for a little cottage industry of making stuff as and when. And then I do lots of freelance stuff. Ben does lots of freelance stuff. And it all kind of fits in around each other. So it's a bit less, I don't have to report to anybody. Yeah. As a result, I've got no one to go to for money.
And because you are, you know, you're quite nimble in terms of you haven't got loads of overheads, et cetera, was that part of your thinking behind relocating to Scotland?
No, that was more just a bit of a breakdown. It was just
you'd had enough of London. And
yeah, I think so. Just before I left Zeppotron, I remember one January, I enrolled on a beer brewing course in Sheffield for like 2 weeks. And I took 2 weeks off, I went up there. And I was living in this really bad travel lodge, it was a travel lodge on top of a Wetherspoons. And it was like January. And I was going to this course every day with all these blokes who were a bit older than me, had all been kind of got taken voluntary redundancy. And there was on the second week, I think I was shoveling hops into a vat in this little farm in like freezing weather. And a bloke turned to me and went, what happened with your job? I went, oh no, I've still got my job. And he goes, what did you got? I work in telly. And he went, the fuck are you doing here? And I went, oh yes, good point. So I went back. But I thought, oh, I've had enough of telly, I'm going to start brewing beer. And that didn't work out. And I was going to move down to the south coast and I found this plot. Oh God. And we went down there and like, it was just, that was a bad idea to move. But then a few years later, me and my wife were on holiday and we went for a walking holiday up here and went, God, imagine living up here. And then it became a kind of joke. And 5 months later, we put an offer on a house up here and just decided to give it like a couple of years and see what happened.
And how are you finding it?
Yeah, it was 4 years ago. I love it. Like, I'm so pleased I did it. It was kind of running away from telly, to be honest. I thought, I wonder if I can, and I was on planes a lot for the first couple of years because I was traveling up and down and from Inverness Airport, you can fly down in like an hour and a half, and doing lots of work in London and then coming back. And then my plan was over time to do less and less flying. And obviously now with COVID and everything else and Zoom and everything, it's kind of the normal model. So hopefully as and when things do revert to some modicum of normality, this will still be my life. And we were really lucky. We came up here and we did a couple of urban myths and stuff. And then me and Neil Forsyth went to BBC Scotland to pitch Guilt. And so then it became like a proper, I remember the day before we went there, I thought, oh shit, I've got to have a Scottish company. So I registered Happy Tramp North online the day before so I could walk into BBC Scotland and go, yeah, I'm a Scottish company now. That was quite handy. Although even that, right, I didn't do any research. And going for a meeting at the BBC is a four-hour drive from here because I'm so far north. It's like going for a meet. It's like living in Ealing and going, I'm just going for a quick meeting in Leeds. I'm back this afternoon. But it's like nuts. It's so far out of the way.
And what point did you get into the Buddhist lock?
It's funny, isn't it?
I listened to an episode of the podcast. I can't believe it's not Buddha. And you were referring to the book, The Power of Now, as that sort of being a starting point, a launch pad in terms of it, because it's quite, there are obviously like religious aspects to it, but in a way there is sort of like a general secular feel to it.
It doesn't feel that overly threatening.
It doesn't feel too totally. Threatening, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. There are no robes or bells in that book.
No, exactly.
And it's just a weird little German fella with a strange voice when you hear him on the audiobooks. You go, this isn't what I'd imagined that would be. Yeah, no, well, so that was Lee and I had talked about doing podcasts for ages, but never wanted to do something that we weren't interested in. We didn't want to magic up Lee and Neil talk to you about lawnmowers because we're not interested in lawnmowers, you know?
Yeah.
And then we've both been into it and we've both given up boozing. And that was all, but you know, all of that stuff in retrospect, giving up drinking, moving to Scotland was all I was fortunate enough to be in a position where I could work remotely a lot of the time.
Mm.
And so all of those things going, I am definitely searching for something more or something different to this. And as I've got older, I've got better at doing things on a whim, because doing things on a whim is no different. Planning is bullshit. Going, you know, in 5 years' time, I'm going to move out or do that. You go, well, if you can do it now, why aren't you doing it now? And only because you're scared, right? And I moved up here and definitely probably had a bit of a breakdown when I got here and thought, what the fuck have I done?
Mm.
But still, I knew that I'd do something. And so that was all part of the same thing, the Buddhism thing. I don't know how I started, but I've been doing like the Headspace app.
Okay.
Which a lot of people kind of find, don't they? Which is,
yeah.
And I've been doing that on and off for like 6 years. And I can't remember why I started that. I know that I tried to meditate when I was like about 15. I got a book from the library and did it in my room and thought, I don't know what this is. And I didn't, and just felt odd and stopped. So there was all like going way back, there was some kind of
thing. Yeah, some pull towards it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and then 5 years ago, definitely giving up drinking was part of that. And Lee was kind of, and we weren't even talking about it, but we were kind of doing it at the same time. And now and again, I go, oh, I'm doing this. He goes, oh, yeah, I'm doing that. And so we'd recommend a couple of things, but then it would come and go. And then after I moved up here, I just found, and even then, it wasn't when I first moved here. After I got here, I went on a retreat. I started meditating a bit more, and it just started to kind of snowball a bit.
What was the retreat that you went on?
I've been on like, well, there's all, I don't, because I talk about them in the podcasts.
Yeah.
And I'm really careful to not name anybody or anything, because I'm the idiot in it. But I do say things that aren't, like in the podcast, on the last retreat I went to, I talked about, I was weighing over my head. So I went to this retreat and it was in between lockdowns, and they had also, suddenly one of the retreats opened and said, oh, we're taking people for this weekend. I thought, oh, great, I'll go on this retreat. Turns out there was three of us that had invited and just the six people who lived there. So these, normally they'd have 15 people, but because of COVID, these blocks that held like five people each, they just had one in each. So it was us at their place. And they said, oh, we're just going to like meditate for like 8 hours a day. And I'm used to doing 20 minutes a day. So day one, I was like, it was like my mind was blown. And I talk about on the podcast, probably the first 4 hours is me talking about getting pins and needles in my penis when I was just in a position that I couldn't sit. And I just didn't know what to do myself. I thought, how is this out? Right. And it just, so it becomes, those are the stories that I that we do on the podcast. But as a result, I don't particularly like naming the places because I feel a bit like, you know. But yeah, so I've done a few of them. I did an online one a couple of weeks ago.
What sort of impact or effect has it had on your life as a whole?
Like massive, a massive impact. Yeah. So you're a Buddhist, right?
Buddhist, yeah.
Buddhist, or Buddha atheist, or
Buddha,
I've heard that one. That's good.
I'm a Buddha. I would reluctantly. I describe myself always when I talk to people about it as a bad Buddhist.
Right. Well, yeah, but there's no good and bad. We know that. If you're Buddhist, you know you're just saying that as a kind of just to make it easier for them. You're just sugarcoating the pill for them, right? I'm a bad Buddhist, but that means like.
I don't know. I feel like I think there's different ways you can get into it. Yeah. You know, some people get into it just purely, as you were saying before, about curiosity. Mm. And, you know, it can progress from there. For me, I feel like if I don't do that, sort of, I'd go off the rails. I need something like that to just keep me steady, you know.
So what do you do? Do you meditate every day?
Yeah, I meditate every day. I realized it 2 days ago. I was like, I need to do more, because at the moment I find, I don't know about you, if I do like 20-25 minutes a day, all that is maintenance. That's like just, you know, it's like an MOT, it's nothing more. You're not really going that much deeper. Whereas when I do an average like 45 to an hour, where's that, like when you go on a retreat, your mind just feels like it's been completely upgraded.
So where have you been on retreats?
I can say, because I haven't
I haven't slagged them off
yet. I go to the moot, they're called Tree Ratner.
Tree Ratner. Yeah. So that's where I've been.
Okay. Well, we might have seen each other. One of my first ones I went to, they did at the time these sub 35s or 35s and under, and
I wouldn't have made that for a long time.
This was back in the day. And then I went with a friend of mine who I guess I would describe as a bit of like a Cole Pilkington type figure. Right. And we got there and everyone's in the dorm, similar to actually what you and Lee were talking about in terms of Lee not wanting to be in a dormitory. We got there and he took one look in there and he's like, nah. The following day, we're all sitting there in the retreat room and I look up him and there's a fly buzzing around his head and it's sort of very quiet. And he just went and just swatted and killed this fly. You know, just at the moment we're talking about loving and not harming all living beings.
Yeah.
Amazing. And it was one of those experiences. But that aside, just, I don't know about you, just have this moment. You're just like, oh, okay, this is kind of a thing that I have been subconsciously looking for. And it's just like, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. It's like going to a car wash, isn't it? Your car comes out nice and clean. You just feel completely revitalized after.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And I think it's a thing like for me, and like, you know, me and Leah are a kind of similar thing, although I've probably got into it a bit more than him recently. It's the kind of thing, once you've started it, you're kind of on that road, unless you have some kind of anti-epiphany where you go, it's all bullshit, which I don't think people tend to. I think you go, oh no, this is, I can suddenly see a different motivation for everything I'm doing, a different kind of purpose, and all that other stuff, all the ambition and all of the kind of wrangling becomes less important really quickly. Or it has done for me.
Yeah, no, for me too. Sometimes that in itself is challenging. Because do I want to lose? I don't know if I want to lose my ambition.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah, I know. But then you go, I think that's, you know, I'm a bit older. So I suppose there's a natural bell curve with it anyway. I think it's quite annoying for people around me who are going, oh, we're pitching this project. Go, yeah, if you like, you know. I find it massively liberating. It's all liberation, isn't it? And now I've gone through that thing. So we started with Eckhart Tolle and the Power Now. Certainly for the purposes of the podcast, we've been kind of focusing on that quite a lot. And it's a really weird one, our podcast, because I do all the email. We get emails in and I respond to all the emails. And there's definitely a kind of, I don't know how many people are listening to it, but a proportion of them are blokes who have gone, I've kind of been looking for this kind of thing, but everything's so po-faced. And you two dicking about, it's a kind of makes me feel like I'm not the only one who is slightly skeptical about it, but also wants to be part of it, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So there's those people, but there's also people who go, can you just stop doing dick jokes and get to the point? Because all you do is interrupt each other. And so it's a weird balance where we're kind of doing what we're doing anyway, but of how deeply we go into it. And I'm probably, well, both of us, but at the moment, I'm probably more into it than I kind of am on the podcast.
Yeah. You've got to play up to that character to a certain
degree. So there's a bit of that thing of going, oh, you know, I've just watched another Ramana Maharshi film. We should talk about that. And he's going, oh, like, calm down. We haven't done the Four Noble Truths yet, you know.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing where you're just going off and I've got massively kind of seduced by non-duality. And I don't know if you've read any Rupert Spira and all of that stuff.
Rupert Spira? No, I haven't actually.
Oh man, Being Aware of Being Aware is a great book.
Okay.
I really recommend. And that all goes back. And then he's kind of idol. Like everybody is peddling something that already exists, right? So Eckhart Tolle is telling you nothing that hasn't been said before.
Sure.
Rupert Spira is doing nothing. And there's always something that we're always kind of butting up against is the kind of industry of mindfulness and Buddhism. And
it is a massive industry.
The tea towel. They've all got tea towels, right? Get your Eckhart Tolle tea towel. It's the kind of where you get to.
Yeah.
And you're releasing another book that's saying the same thing.
Mm.
That's commerce, right? Like even like I got into Wim Hof and all of that stuff, the breathing thing, which I think is brilliant.
Did you do the cold showers?
Oh yeah, I do all of that.
Yeah, I do the cold showers.
And the problem with all of this stuff is, and this is the kind of joke at home, is that my daily routine is insane. I have to get up to
that's the thing. You get up at 4 in the morning.
Yeah. And then you're breathing for like half an hour, then you've got a cold shower. And if you want to do some exercise, and then if you want to do it a bit in the evening, it's like I've got a family, right? You can't just go, I'm going off for another 2 hours now. Please don't interrupt me.
Yeah, and it's almost like if you do then go on to have a shit day, you're like, bloody hell, what else can I do? I've had 5 hours morning routine. I'm still not feeling great.
Yeah. And then, I don't know, So then, but it's I think great.
It is great. And going back to think about ambition, although, it you might sort of like loosen your grip to ambition. At the same time, I think that is definitely healthy. But from a creative perspective, I've found, I'm sure you're the same, that has had a positive impact in that respect.
Yeah. Well, I think there's the creatively, it's always best when you're in the process and not worrying about the future or the past, right? It's the same thing, like what they call flow or whatever.
Flow state,
that thing, where you go, when I'm writing something or I'm playing some music or I'm doing something and I'm in the moment, I'm creating it, that's the best bit. And so the problem with when you're doing it as a job is you're worrying about whether someone's going to like it or commission it or recommission it or what the figures are, or you're worrying about your last show didn't do very well, so maybe people you'll go down in their estimation, all that stuff. And that's all bullshit. But from a Buddhist perspective, the making of the thing is the Buddhist moment, because there is only now and all of that.
Yeah.
There isn't that old show. It doesn't exist.
And
nor does that future one.
No, exactly. Yeah. Nor does the TV. The TV is just made up of all the individual parts that make the TV.
But there's not even a TV there.
Yeah.
Non-dualism, we're the same thing. Like we're pretending to be separate entities and we're not even separate entities. But then it starts getting like, that's when people start to glaze over and go, all right, you're nut job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I love The Matrix.
You need to have a chat with Lee. Like he'll talk to you about The Matrix all day long.
I watched it the other day just to give myself a little bit of a, need it every now and then.
Yeah.
When you're sort of going more and more down the Buddhist path, did that coincide with you going vegan as well?
I'm not vegan. Like Lee keeps telling everyone I'm vegan and I'm not vegan. I eat fish.
Is it what he says on the podcast, despite knowing that you're not?
All the time. Oh, yeah, because we're vegans. Like, I'm not. I keep, like every maybe third podcast, like I'm not vegan. Yeah. I eat fish. I think is probably, I don't know, I probably shouldn't eat fish, but it was more kind of, in the broader sense, it was a kind of environmental decision, I think. I didn't like the notion of eating meat. I don't miss meat. And
it's funny, isn't it, how that craving just goes after a while. I used to be a massive
meat. But it's the same with booze as well, I think, for me. Like, it's such a weird thing that, like, I was pretty good at it. And, I definitely wasn't a problem drinker, but I drank loads of it. I was really good. And since I've stopped, I've gone, God, it's much better without it. Like, I have a much better time, I think. Well, no, I know I do. But that's the weird one. We get quite a lot because there's quite a lot of, again, probably predominantly blokes who get in touch with the podcast who go, they're interested in the non-drinking thing. And some people get in touch and go, you do come across as a couple of really smug pricks when you talk about non-drinking, which again is an entirely valid point.
Mm.
But that interests me quite a lot, the non-drinking thing.
Yeah, and I do find it interesting sometimes when people react in that way so viscerally because, I don't know, maybe it's sort of like that's triggering something in it within there.
Yeah, of course. You know,
so
yeah. It's always your mate that goes, have a drink, just have one. And then he's about a week later goes, so how did you do it?
Exactly that.
So aside from the Buddhism, what have you done historically? I know because we're in COVID, so it changes things somewhat. What have you done historically to outside of work to take your mind off all things career-wise and relax and unwind?
I play a lot of music. I played in a lot of bands before I left London. Up here, I go swimming in the sea quite a lot, which I love.
They're cold water swimming.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's cold water. It's Scotland, so...
Yeah, like it's properly cold
water.
Yeah. I do it in a wetsuit. Like, I think I'd die if I didn't have a wetsuit on. But I like doing that. I like just going out. I like... One of the reasons we came here is because we just like... There's so much. If you're into kind of wandering about, there are mountains and beaches and forests everywhere around here. So you can just drive, like, you can drive 20 minutes in any direction and end up in somewhere you've never seen before and you probably never see again, you know, because it's just so much. So I love it. So yeah. I'm kind of, we moved up here, got a dog, and I'm just really into wandering around.
Is it challenging creating a social life there? Or did you already know people?
We didn't know anybody, and I still don't. That's not true.
You like
no,
it?
It's not true. No, like my wife's really good. She's really social. Okay. And I'm really social with people that I have met, but I don't tend to go, and I'm really happy in my own company. I can go for weeks without leaving the house.
Okay.
And like I've got, you know, my kids are a bit older. They're 12 and 15. So they're like as much company as I need. Like they're like kind of, we watch films together and we play games and muck about and we all get on. So I have got mates up here, but not like, I've got like a handful of mates that I've met over the few years, but yeah. I was never massively social beforehand. So
okay, perfect. Then.
I'm really lucky that it's made very little difference to my life.
Yeah, sounds it. Are there any books that you've read over the years that have had an impact on you in any way? Doesn't have to be industry related.
What's his name? Story by.
I know you mean.
It had a real impact on me. I can't remember his name. I'm a big Steinbeck fan, but I don't think it's had a big influence on me other than that they're just great stories.
Yeah.
I was a massive Hunter Thompson fan when I was younger, but nothing work-wise, nothing really. And now I'm just reading. I'm getting recommendations. I've got a really bad habit of every time someone emails, I can't believe it's not Buddha, and with a recommendation, I immediately order it. So I've honestly got about 100. Like there are so many books, right? Every time you, like someone goes, oh, you should read Alan Watts. Someone says, oh, you should read Mahana Maharshi. Oh, have you not even seen this yet? And you just go, God. So
you're not enlightened by the end of that reading list. You're gonna
and they all say the same thing. I think it's a really weird thing that the more I read them generally, because we talk about this a lot, this thing where you go, if you read a Buddhist book, you sometimes in the middle of reading the book you go, oh, this is it, right? This is totally nailed it. And you go, I've got it, and you put the book down, and the next day you go, what was it? What was that thing? And I think it's because, you know, at the heart of a load of that teaching is you can't intellectualize awareness. You can't intellectualize being. And so the moment you try and think your way through it, you're going to always hit a block because it's beyond kind of thought. And so I think what happens is you read the book, and while you're reading the book, you get the emotive response, which is being, but you're tying it to what you're reading. So then when you put the book down, you go, I'm trying to remember what I was reading. And you go, it's not about that. That thing is just broken that emotion open. You don't have to remember what was in the book. You just have to recall the emotion you were feeling, and that's awareness. That's what. So I think actually you read loads of books and they're kind of like drugs. They're almost immaterial what's in them, as long as they're in the vein of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like self-help books. Yeah. After a while, they're all saying the same thing. But the challenge is, as you said, it's like digesting the intellectual interpretation of it. But also then I always find I have a week, or I might have however long it is, where I'm, you know, doing loads of meditation every day and I feel like, you know, I feel present, etc. But then suddenly that just goes completely like all over the place. And a week later, I've got a complete lack of awareness. And I'm being pulled in different directions. The challenge is just maintaining it. And I don't even know
that's part
possible.
Of it, right? The clouds are part of it.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's that thing when you go, when you're mental, and so many people have that thing of going, oh, I can't stop these thoughts in my mind. And it's such a challenge to new people when they start meditating. They think they're doing it wrong because you go, oh, I keep being told to focus on my breath, and then I'm thinking about the washing, or punching my neighbor in the face or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you go, no, but that's it.
That is
the meditating. Being aware of that and almost being annoyed at it initially is the meditating.
Yeah.
Because you're engaging with it and you engage. So it's hard because I'm exactly as you. Sometimes I go, oh God, I've been a week of feeling so kind of centered and in the moment. And then a week later, I go, what's happened to me? You know, like five things have happened that have all turned the screw a little bit. And I've got, but you go, oh, you know, but this is it. The fact that I'm asking this question is the same thing. It's all the same thing.
Conditions obviously help. You could have the perfect conditions. I'm sure your conditions right now probably are helpful to you. Rather than being in London, you're now in the sort of in amongst nature. But that aside, you can be in the perfect conditions. You can go on a retreat and you might feel like I've really uncovered something here. You know, if I've had a certain sense of awareness. But inevitably, once you come back, you're in the real world. You're never going to escape that unless you are literally living in a cave in the Himalayas.
So there's
always going to be that challenge.
Yeah, let's do it.
Just doing, mate.
What are we doing?
You're right. Me, I'm in bloody Hackney right now.
Doesn't matter. Makes no difference. I'm saying, what a privileged prick. Doesn't matter where you are, he says, sitting in the mountains. ultimately, acceptance, isn't it? It's all acceptance.
Yeah, yeah. That it is. And that's that in itself is a challenge.
Yeah. It is, but it isn't. Have you read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind?
I don't think I have. That one has popped up quite a few times in conversations, but I haven't read that. I've heard it's fantastic.
And it's great because it's the most annoying book. Like it encapsulates that thing of going, it's all or nothing and you can't think your way through it and just do it and don't do it. It is like it's a Koan idea as a book.
Okay.
And once you get through, you go, everything is Zazen, you know, cutting your toenails is Zazen if your mindset is right.
Yeah.
But it's puts up so many dilemmas. There's an end bit of the book that drives Lee nuts where it goes, it's something like in the morning there's aubergines and in the afternoon it's cucumbers or something like that. Right. It's not that, but it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And you go, I think that's the point. I think the point is there's no sense to be got from this.
Mm.
And I think it's stopping thinking, right? The great irony is that we're reading these things to learn how to stop thinking. Inbuilt in that is you're using your thinking mind to process what the idea is.
Yeah, I guess. And then with the hope that it will just start festering and then you start becoming aware in a way where you're not necessarily overly aware.
You've made it sound like a fungal infection.
I have. I was thinking that as I said it.
Really festers.
Yeah, the opposite to enlightenment. I think there is a danger with it all that you can get a little bit Woody Allen-esque with it. You know, you could go overly neurotic with it to a certain degree.
Yeah.
If you're not careful.
Yeah. Like totally. But I think that again, it's the central, contradiction of it that in actively seeking it and thinking about it, you're making it harder for yourself. Like there were points that I found some solace in the thing of going, oh, not thinking and being quite inert is quite a good natural state. Mm-hmm. I can get through a whole day without without giving a fuck about anything. They're just sitting there just going, oh, it doesn't matter, is it? And it's almost like being a pensioner, I suppose. And I just go, oh, yeah, I'd had a good day today because I didn't really engage with anything because there's nothing to engage with. And I go, what I did engage with is I went and saw a beach that I liked. And that's lucky because I've got that to see, right? But then there's parks, all those things. But not engaging with things, I think, is the key.
Mm.
It sounds like giving up, but it's not, I think. I'm getting better. I do think I might be going in a kind of upswing at the moment, but I do think I'm really getting better at it and I'm really enjoying it in that kind of calm way.
Would you say, or has your friends noticed a difference in you since you got into it? Or do you think it's one of those things where it's such a gradual process? You're not going to, it's like if someone sees you, haven't seen you for 5 years, they probably see a noticeable change compared to someone who you see relatively often.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I say, I haven't got that many friends, so it's hard to quantify. like friends that I haven't seen since I came up boozing will notice a difference, but that'll be the boozing more than anything else.
Rather than else, yeah.
But I think so. I think, like, you know, the only people that really care what they think of me is my family, and they seem to tolerate me, and I seem to be winding them up a little bit less. So that's a good barometer.
Yeah,
I think I think it's weird because me and my wife gave up drinking at the same time, and that's that was different. Well, I don't think it'll work any other way, because I think you're on. That's a massive problem with that thing. When people say about giving up drinking, we were like a boozy party family.
Right.
We had a lot of, like, I had kind of an open door, people around our house the whole time.
Okay.
And so if one of us had given up, it just wouldn't have worked. It would just been, we're in different gears the whole time. So it's lucky that we both did.
Do you not miss that? So,
no. No, I really don't. I really don't. I always remember like start drinking at like 11:30 on a Sunday when I started to cook something, when people coming over, and because I was like, a lot of people played instruments, they'd all bring them over, and I had this basement in this house, we'd all play in the basement. It was great fun.
Yeah.
But I always remember kind of fighting the booze in my head from about 1:30.
Okay.
Also that feeling of going, oh, and I just drink stronger and stronger stuff to try and, to try and kind of keep it going. But you just go, oh, I'm just, the clarity's gone a bit, and I'm trying to focus on playing something or cooking something. And you know that feeling when you go, I've had like 4 glasses of red wine, and I'm a bit groggy now, and I'm trying to, and I just don't miss that. And at the time, I always thought, oh, I like, we're going to come out, we're going to have a party on Sunday, it'll be amazing. And I always remember being at like 1, 2 o'clock thinking, oh, I'm a bit groggy now.
Mm.
Push on through, get absolutely hammered. That'll sort it out. And, you know, and I'll tell you what, if I never have a hangover for as long as I live, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I can relate. Final question I'm going to ask you is, what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
I think it means calmness. I think that's what balance is. I think it's, without, I was slightly reticent, feel like I'm banging on, but I think it is, that's, it's awareness, right? It's being, it's the witness, all of those things that you discover in Buddhism. That's what it all is. That's what it all is, right? So balance is just calmness. And whether that means not getting angry, not getting overly excited by anything, because that will pass too, not getting stressed. And it's easy to not get stressed, but actually behind it, all those things are going to come and go, and the calmness is still there beneath it all, and that's the balance. And it's, that's the way, that's the direct path stuff. This is all that Ramana Maharshi stuff, where it's the idea that enlightenment is, in some traditions, is like 6 lifetimes away, but the direct path goes, no, it's there now. You're in line, you can be aware now, but then it's how, once you've discovered that awareness, it's turning back and applying that to your life. You don't have to spend 6 lifetimes searching for awareness or the knowing or whatever that thing is. It's what you are, and it's just uncovering that, and that's the calmness. So that's balance, I think. And I realize I sound like some kind of evangelist at this point.
No, that's a superb answer. Guys, thank you, Neil. Been great chatting.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for coming on and giving me your time. Really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
I know you are more of a behind the scenes kind of guy, but now you obviously have the podcast. Is that the best thing in terms of people to check out? I can't believe it's not Buddha.
Like, it's literally the only thing.
Okay.
So it's really easy. If you want to avoid me, it's really, really easy to do so. But if you do want to see it, hear it, yeah, that's it. Can't believe it. I don't know how long we're going to do it for. We might finish. No, we will do a bit longer.
Until you reach enlightenment.
Well, that's already happened, because I found the direct path. I've reached awareness. I'm just nurturing it now.
Yeah. Well, cool. Until you get reincarnated to the next life.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Totally. And then we'll do it again in our next forms.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Cheers, man.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.